distraction masses. This piece of fiction is the intro to distraction masses. This piece of fiction is the intro to distraction masses. This piece of fiction is the intro to distraction masses. Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 293 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, and it's a really important one to me. Obviously, it's a bonus here. It's a Monday, but there's a really important cause that I wanted to do a bit of a different episode about. Many of you will know, if you're regular listeners, I have a stutter or a stammer. I've had it since I was about 4 years old. I've talked about it in different situations. In one of my first ever songs, A Thousand Words, I kind of tell the story of how I got my stammer and growing up with my stammer and stuff like that. So I was asked recently to become a patron of Stammer, which is the British Stammering Association. So I'm stuttering so much more than I usually do, which is the British Stammering Association. And tomorrow, October 22nd, is International Stammering Awareness Day. I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff. I'm going to be taking over and doing a Q&A. I think we're going to be doing it on the Stammer Instagram page, which is STAMMAUK, Stammer UK. I might do some stuff on their Twitter page too, which is at Stammer, STAMMER. I know that's confusing that there's two different ones there, but yeah, you can also head to stammer.org and I'm sure we'll have all the information there. So that's STAMMA.org. But generally, on any of the socials, if you search either the British Stammering Association or STAMMA or STAMMER, you'll find it. As said, it's an organisation that means a lot to me and I'm proud to be involved with. As you will have heard, if you heard my King's speech at Christmas, it's an emotional organisation to be involved with. It's made me confront a lot of things. But one of the best things it's made me do is this podcast. So I've sat down with three different people who have stammers. And they're just 20 to 30 minute chats about how it was growing up with a stammer, what they would like people who don't have a stammer to know about having a stammer, and what they would like people who do have a stammer to know and are struggling. And I'm really pleased with them and I really enjoyed them. I can't remember if I mentioned it in this, but stammers and stutters are kind of easily overlooked at times as a disability. In fact, I do. I talk about it in the last one, I think, with Owen Shears. But those who have a stammer, as you'll hear, have had to grow up without freedom of speech. And I know that sounds dramatic, but it's true. We've had to adapt. We've had to avoid words. We've not been able to say what we want to say. And that's a big deal, man. Anyway, I won't ramble on too much. As I said, this is an extended episode because it's three mini episodes in one. The first person I want to introduce you to is an actor, a young man called George Fletcher. And it was a pleasure to chat to him. You're going to hear he's an absolute joy. So, yeah, let's get into the first conversation. This is George Fletcher. So we are rolling. Right, I'm starting each of these by saying, can you state your name, your age and your occupation?
I'm George Wilson, or George Fletcher. I'm 26 years old and I'm an actor.
And the actor part is the reason that you're George Wilson or George Fletcher, right? Yeah, is one your stage.
That's why.
Yeah.
George Fletcher is my stage name, but it's my middle name and my dad's middle name as well. So yeah, it was quite an easy adjustment.
Yeah.
But I find on form filling, I always tend to kind of like, you know, it gets sort of confused and it's all a bit, but yeah.
It's confusing on day-to-day life, right? I'm someone who has obviously a fake name, but it's a name I had since I worked in HMV that my mates know me as. But when I'm at something new and I'm having to introduce myself to someone, I'm like, so who am I? What am I meant to?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi. It's awkward. But I mean, again, it's nice that we've both chosen our names as such. We're both acting. And we've both got
a speech impediment. This is going to be a tough... I should have checked this problem. What do you refer to yours? Because I've always felt I had a stutter, but I know that stammer is the more regular term.
I used stammer because I had speech therapy when I was about 12.
Yeah.
And they sat me down and told me, like, for some reason they were, like, really, really specific on it, that stammer is UK and stutter is US. So I always use stammer, but no one else really seems to, so it tends to be stutter. But also stutter's really hard to say. There's something quite cruel about having people with speech impediments and they say stutter.
Yeah.
Because it's quite difficult. But yeah, I say stammer.
It's a funny one because I didn't know that it was a UK and US thing until I started working with stammer and the BSA because... I thought there was a difference in what they were. Mm. And as a kid, I'd been told that mine was a stutter. Other people have a stammer. I still don't know. I don't remember what they told me the difference was.
Yeah.
But they probably didn't. They probably just said, oh, you got a stutter. And I've then backwards engineered this, that what I've got is this. There's another thing called this.
There's two strands of it. Like you've got a specific sort of diagnosis. They've gone, look, Pitt, you've got...
You've got this version.
We've got the form here for you and we have to tell you now it's a stutter. That's what you've got.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't, as I said, until I started work with Jane and that. And I'm like, always the American one of stutter. I was like, oh, is that an Americanization? So what's your kind of earliest memory of your stammer?
That's really hard. I was actually thinking about this recently and I was speaking to my mum. And one of my first memories is actually going to an NHS referral thing because I couldn't say my D's or my G's. So I've always had speech problems. That must have formed about 3 or so.
Yeah.
And then it's really weird because it's sort of like saying, well, what's your first memory of cars? Like, yeah. I don't have a memory of speech fluency at all. And that's what I think most of my memories, because there's these films with me on, like, you know, family holidays, and I'm just... garbled, like I'm just talking with such, you know, sort of passion and verve and stuff, and my dad's filming me and then desperately trying to, like, sort of get me out of shot because I just won't stop speaking.
Yeah.
So I think it's hard when you're a kid. Also, I wasn't, like, sort of self-conscious about it, and I think also because I spoke so much and had so much to say and so much that actually if I tripped over words I wasn't really aware of it, or it didn't really matter, or there wasn't any social shame, I'd been socialised into thinking it was strange.
Yeah.
Most of my memories of stammering start in high school. And that's when it's sort of a bit more... I don't know, I think the way I think about my stammer and like a culture... I don't know if you have this, but like I've almost built up a way of speaking about it, a culture, an understanding.
Yeah.
Like I've done like a PhD in my stammer. I've got all these theories about it and all these things. Those really start age 11 or 12. So I always had the speech, you know, problems or impediment, but it's only really when I got to about 11 or 12 that I really... found it irksome or found it sort of difficult or it started to actually kind of affect my life.
It's really telling how common that is because it reveals that the problem is much more with people who don't stammer and their understanding of a stammer and their reaction to a stammer than the stammerer themselves, if you know what I mean. That I was the same. I had a stammer since I was 4 or something. Mm. I don't have any memories of it being an issue until I was at school. Because as you said, if your friends and family around you aren't reacting to it and haven't told you it's an unusual thing, then it's not an issue. It's when you go somewhere and someone, again, school for me was the easy example because, and it's weird now, but because you've mentioned the building up your own kind of framework, I think you also build up almost your own interview answers.
Yeah.
That I've said this a million times, but at school... they read out a register and you have to respond. And you're the first, that's the first day of school. Everyone at school is looking for someone to be the target that's not them.
Yeah.
You know, so if the first thing you have to do is respond and you can't do it properly, there's our target.
It's also tricks that you get as well. It's like, I know in high school, it was weird because I've always done, you know, drama and acting and stuff since I was about 3 or 4 and always loved it. And it was the thing that, I was liberated from, in a way. Like, you know, my stammer never really affected acting. And when I got to high school, it's like doing read-arounds in English or whatever, and I used to count how many, you know, people there were until me, and then look down at whatever we were reading, if that was a poem or Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And then the fear would start. And I don't know if you had this. I would start to select words that would be like a problem, or, you know, if it's a P, if it's a plosive sound, and, you know, so... really, by the time it got to me, I'd worked myself up into this kind of frenzy.
Yeah.
And also, I don't know if you had this, I had tricks, which I had.
Yes.
Which from the outside must have looked bizarre. Like, I was thinking, like, I'd, like, rock out of the chair, I'd kind of put my arm up, I would pretend I hadn't heard them and then say, what was that? Sorry. And then that would lead me into it. It's all about finding these odd ways. And it's, and I think also that thing about high school is that suddenly you have to deal with a range of social situations you don't really have to do. When you're 9 years old, you're not going to be on the phone to people that much you don't know, or ordering something in, like, you know, like a coffee shop, or having to speak to new people. Yeah. And it's actually what's hard for me sort of growing up is that, and I don't know if this says more about me than actually stammering or whatever, but, like, I didn't want anyone to think I was stupid.
Yeah.
Really didn't want anything to think I'm stupid. And I found, like, you know, speaking on the phone or doing anything that was quite mundane, you know, like anything like, you know, what's your name, what's your address, what's your phone number, stuff like that, which is just instantly in your head and is easy, I could never really do.
Yeah.
And social situations with strangers, when they'd ask me, what, you know, what my mum's name was, and there'd always be that horrible thing where there'd be some sort of delay or I'd have to do something to kind of get out of it. And then this weird social situation, we've got someone staring at you going, right, you don't know your own mother's name, or you don't know your own address.
Yeah.
And it's that thing of, like, and I don't know if you have this, but, like, I'd never admit it. I would never go, sorry about that. I occasionally have a speech, you know, problem, I've a fluency problem.
Completely.
Thank you. Whereas I would kind of feign and act and kind of throw myself around a little bit.
Still to this day, I have that every now and then. And it's interesting you said about the coping mechanisms there, because that was going to be one of my questions, and the ones that you've described are so familiar to me. And the way I think of it is, you know, in kind of a cartoon, when someone runs off, they'll do a little jump in the air first and then go.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like with a stamina. Absolutely. You're getting yourself off the thing. And mine would often be a faking that I'm thinking about it. So it'd be because it's taking that sharpness off of the start. So dying, come, you know, just to get past that D, you're putting an at the beginning of it, because I don't stutter on D's in the middle of a word.
No.
So if I now make every word that begins with D have a bit of a pause as if I'm thinking, then I can get through that, and it gives me that running start at it, as such, is the way I always think of it. And I love that you were, I've just realised I should describe that in, that you were moving around in your seat and moving up and things like that. To
and
kind
it's
of
not
go,
small movements. It's not like a little adjustment. It's not like a, you know, like a small sort of economical shift.
Yeah.
Like it was, it because obviously it got harder and harder, and I became more and more self-conscious that, you know, I was standing up some days, you know, I was really, like, really odd behaviour.
Yeah.
With your stamina, do you find, are there sounds which you always find hard, or is your stamina a changing thing day by day, where you're at, or have you always sort of struggled with D's or?
I think it's every time I think I've got it figured out, it proves me wrong.
Yeah.
I go, oh, it's always them, and then I'll have no problem with that, and I'll start on something else. It's like, all right, it's not that. And again, it's one of the things I found fascinating in working with Stammer and the BSA is I'm learning loads more about it, because again, as you said, because it's not something you want to bring attention to, it's something that I've spent 30 plus years of my life not really understanding. Mm. And not that I understand it now, but in just meetings with these guys, they've pointed stuff out to me.
I've never spoken to a stammerer before. I've never spoken really properly to a stammerer before in this way and gone, is that what you do? Is that, and it's, you know, it's not saying, but I think their work's amazing, because it's just more about understanding it. Because especially, like, you know, I think most people's speech impediments probably form in, like, 9 or 10 years old, around then. And, you know, that like, no one really tells you what it is. They just tell you that it's okay, or how to cope with it, or they're very patient with you, or they're not patient with you. But no one really, like, even now, I don't really know that much about it. And that's why I wanted to get more involved with them, just because it's something I'm realizing. I'm 26 now, and I'm like, there's this whole side of me that I really can't deal with or talk about.
Yeah.
I can't talk about not sometimes, you know, being able to talk. And it's actually funny, because my family, there's stammering in my family, and my younger brother, Harry, he's 24 and he stammers.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting, because he's never made it personal. It's like, it's a very occasional tick, and he works in, like, a restaurant, and it's very, very fast paced, and he's great at what he does and with you know, some people, and he's like a manager in quite a swanky new place. But when I talk to him about it, I go, you know, so what's it like for you, like in your head, those moments of, you know, there's like a suspension and then you do this and that, how do you, and he just goes, I'll just change what word I say, and sort of like, he just doesn't have any relation to it, which I find mind boggling, because I have a whole culture and a whole failed understanding, or I have all this built up stuff about it. But yeah, it's what I found interesting was through school, I'd have these bad patches and then like a good patch, and I'd always try and understand what that was like.
Yeah.
And then in my late teens, I kind of become a lot more held. So I would sort of like, I managed to get through it. You know, those tricks became more in the way that I held myself, and I could be more selective. But then when I went to drama school, age 21, and going to drama school, first year is a lot of like, you don't breathe right, you don't talk right, you don't stand up straight right, you don't do this right. And having all of that, you know, deconstructed quite quickly. I don't think anyone in my class knew I had a stammer until probably about 2 weeks in. And we did this exercise where we had to look at the wall and then turn around and face the whole class and not change the way that we held ourselves. It was all about, you know, just being comfortable, not putting anything on. And it was hysterical because I would be looking at the wall and then just before I met everyone else, I'd change my whole body. And they really, and then they would try, I think they were getting us to do speeches while doing it or something. And that's when it just came out, and it didn't come out in a light way. It was like a physical block. I couldn't speak at all. And from then and then from that point on, it was like it was in the room.
Yeah.
And I stammered throughout my 3 years there, and it was really, really tough. Like more tough than school, because it was like, not only is there like an anxiety, will I work? You know, will I do well? Am I understanding this? But just like day to day, am I going to be able to get a word out? And there were whole classes that I look back on now and go, I wish I could do that now.
Yeah.
Because I'm just not in my head, or I'm not, you know, my main focus isn't, am I going to be able to get this first sound out, or you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's
amazing how having something else you're more scared of can really help.
Yeah.
Again, I'm doing an acting class at the moment, and I'm on the intermediate level now. I've done the basic one. I wanted to do it again, and they've made me move up to intermediate. I feel completely underqualified. And the other day, it was one of them where you've got an option to get up and do something. You don't have to. And at the end of the class, I thought, I'm going to. And I got up and did something. And it's only now that we're talking about it that I've realised I didn't think once about, am I going to stammer? I was scared about getting the lines right, getting the things that we've learned into my performance, try and get these little things, what everyone's going to think. I was shitting myself, but not because I'm someone who stutters, because I'm someone who's never got up in a drama class and done a performance before. So it's weird how the different...
Is that all about focus, do you think? Is that all about...
I think it really can be. I think the focus... And I think it's why I'm sure you'll find that your stammer doesn't affect your acting, because you've got such a focus...
But occasionally, and that's what's been really, really difficult, is that in my childhood, acting was this really safe thing and expression and whatever. And then through drama school, I really struggled with scenes. And actually, my second year, we had a load of industry came in, like, you know, some casting sort of people and whatever. And it was in second year. And in first year drama school, you feel in this little shell, like in like a microcosm. They really look after you. And then suddenly had these like external people in. We had to do scenes for them overnight, and it was all week. And I just couldn't do it. I just could not do it. It was horrible. And I actually got on a train. It's really, really dramatic. I walked out of one because they asked me what my name was, and I couldn't even get through that.
Wow.
And it was like a one-on-one, and I got on a train and then like sort of phoned my mum. And that was like a point where I was like, I could nearly have not sort of come back. Yeah. And that's how big it felt. It was a really, really big thing.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's like, I mean, I'm not sure about you, but like, you know, I sort of go into, you know, so auditions and rooms, and it's not my head at all, not a thing. And then some days I wake up and it's at like the front of my attention.
Yeah.
And that's what's hard, I think, because also I don't quite know how to deal with that. Or
I think acting's a weird industry for people who stammer, and not for the reason that everyone who's listening is going to assume. Not because it involves talking or any of these things, but because it involves completely unexplained rejections that you can then attribute. Do you know what I mean? That make you then start to look at yourself. Did I not get that role because I've got a stammer?
Mm.
Did I stammer in that audition and not realise? Do you know what I mean? Because do you have that as well? Do you have times where you just don't notice it, and other times that you're far more aware.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's days that go by where it doesn't. I don't think about it at all, yeah. Really. And, I mean, I had a thing in third year, you've got all that industry arriving, and, you know, you're doing these big shows. And I had this whole thing, and I had to, like, talk to my family about it, you know, and my partner about it, just being like, you know, what if they all find out, like, some terrible secret, like, somehow I'll be struck off every list in, like, the country.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, it's just, or, like, they'll really care that I'll have a stammer. It's, you know, it's bad news, and it will ruin everything. And it's funny talking about it out loud, because obviously it's so internalised from years and years. Even just talking about it, you just realise that it's not as large as it feels in your head. It's not as big. It's not as, like, you know, final as it feels in your head.
But it's interesting how, no matter how grown up you want to be or how comfortable you get with it, it's not as simple as, I've adjusted my outlook to it. You're still going to have those days and those moments. I talked about this a while ago. I did a post for Stammer when their posters, the billboards had gone up, and it got the biggest reaction of anything I've ever posted on Instagram. It was beautiful. There were so many lovely comments. It was overwhelming. And just before I went to bed, I looked and I saw that three or four of my favourite directors had liked it.
Great.
Which was great until I got into bed and was laying there, and I was like, are they going to think they can't offer me a role now because I've got a stammer? Because I've not really, they probably wouldn't have known.
Even just talking about this with you today.
Is it now going to put me out? Am I going to be like, they can't employ me?
Yeah.
And it's stupid because they're not. And again, it's we've both now got proof that we can do what we're hired to do. But that night, I barely slept. And it was such a silly thing because I'd had such a powerful day of people just saying lovely things and it really meant the world. And then that one thought crept in just before I went to bed and I didn't sleep. I laid there awake all night thinking, I've screwed it. I've been too open. Yeah, I thought openness was a good thing. I've been too open.
It's all out of the box now.
As you said earlier, the secret's out. They're going to have found out.
Yeah.
The secret's out. And I'm the bloody one who told them the secret. I've messed up here. It's mad.
It's funny because I've just done a stage job and I went straight from one thing, you know, to like another one. And then on the first stage job, which was in August, it wasn't a thing in my head at all.
Yeah.
I knew it inside out. It was great. It was a lovely, 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 lovely job. And then I went into another stage job, which was equally lovely, which was great. But just because there was a bit less time and because I was a bit more self-aware, my stammer crept in during rehearsals ever so slightly. And then the first couple of shows, it was just there on some T words.
Mm.
And I spoke to the director on like the last week. I was like, you know, I'm really sorry. You know, thanks for being so patient. And, you know, and I felt like it was something I was always aware of on stage, which wouldn't happen, but would maybe just be something that occasionally just creep up and go, okay, watch that. Okay, that, you know, it'd just be something going on. And I spoke to her about it and she went, oh yeah, it was around in rehearsals a bit, but you know, once the show opened, it was fine, wasn't it? And I was like, wow, you saw the show so many times and you don't, that doesn't even, you know, it's a figure for you. And like my family would come and see it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd be beating myself up and they were like, well, yeah, but you didn't stammer. Like, there was one moment of like a hesitancy, but like that was also like part of the scene. And it's kind of going, well, I'm never going to get rid of it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, and I've had silly moments where I've gone, great, I'm cured now. It's over. You know, I can go to a room and talk to someone. It's great. It's knowing what it is. It's accepting it. And it's also going, if I have a moment of, you know, hesitancy, then that's fine. I think that sounds really, really simple. Really, really simple. But that's taken me like 20 years just to kind of get over.
Yeah. Do you have any specific memories of when someone reacted really badly to it? Or in your eyes, really, their reaction affected you?
I was just laughing, really.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just laughing. And that's understandable because you're like.
And how did you react to their laughter? Were you a laugh along? Were you a run off? Were you a get angry?
I just put my head down, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't really deal with it. And then I think when I was a bit older, I would laugh it off or I'd laugh with it. It's also understandable because you know, if you're young children in a room and someone starts making anything that's like, you know, not sort of normative or subvert, or like, you know, if they start making a funny noise and they laugh. That's reaction is perfectly understandable.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's what I really struggled with. If anything, and to sort of come back to it, if anything, it was less external, it was more internal. So if I had to be, you know, I'd like a reception. I hate receptions because it's so clear cut. I have to stand there. I have to say what my name is,
yeah,
what time I'm supposed to be seen by, or like my phone number or personal details. And it's right. So easy. And that's the things that I struggle with. Whereas if someone goes, oh, so tell me about this thing, and you can talk at length and you've got choice and you can move around and there's time, but it's like factual things, small things. I'm not sure if you find that, but if someone asks me for like an address or a simple bit of information, I just can't do it. It's horrible.
It's the worst. I've had ones before, again, that mechanism of adding things at the beginning of stuff. I've had people writing down an address or something they've asked for, and they're writing an A at the beginning.
Mm.
So it's, I don't know why I keep wanting to go a wizard. I don't know why wizard, who's asking me about a wizard, but
if I'm going, up to
wizard, yeah. And they're writing the A at the beginning. I'm like, no, it's just W, yeah, and things like that. Or
yeah, it just, my G's are really weak, so that, you know, it'll be something with a G, and yeah, I'm like, or like, you know, and they'll kind of go, sorry, what was that? Or like my T's kind of,
yeah,
become quite sloppy as well. And that's always quite hard. But I don't know. It's, I think really what I'm learning to do as well, and I'm not sure if you do this, but just kind of afterwards just going, sorry about that. I've got a stammer and it comes out sometimes.
Yeah.
Which again sounds tiny, but just doing that is easy, is fine, it's honest, you know what I mean? Opposed to kind of pretending that thing in the room didn't happen, that's not...
I'd push you to remove the apology from it.
And, so true.
And just go
so
with true. The informing
so part. True.
Do you know what I mean? Because again, there's nothing so wrong with it, and I think you're right, I think you've made a really key point there in saying that it's natural for kids to laugh at this unusual thing, and I think that's something that gets overlooked in a lot of the important changes that we're making in society. I think one of the most important and most exciting changes is all the changes that we're seeing in trans culture.
Absolutely.
And about time. But I also think it's okay for someone who's not familiar with any of that to be confused at first or to ask a question. They then need to be educated.
Mm.
And similarly, it's okay for kids to find a stutter funny at first. They then need to be educated on it as to why it's not funny. Mm. They shouldn't then just grow up and go, oh, it's okay, it's a funny thing. But that first time and those first interactions, it's perfectly natural to be confused or to not know what's going on or to find it funny. You then educate and you then explain why, you know, I get that this stutter seems funny, but here's what's going on here. And it's not going anywhere.
Mm.
So if you keep laughing,
mm,
it's going to start to be offensive.
Mm.
It's going to start to be rude. It's going to start to be damaging to that person. How are they going to feel if every time they speak you're laughing at them? Do you know what I mean? It's that kind of, it's finding that way to address and educate, I guess.
It's also teachers and adults as well. I don't know how you feel about this, but I think in I always let that person with the stammer finish.
Yeah.
Be as patient as you can.
Well, that's what I was going to ask.
Condescending.
What would you like people who don't have stammers to know about how would be your preferred? And again, it's always key on these things that we're speaking for ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, just it's easy. It's not. I don't know why I'm comparing stammers to trans culture, but I had an amazing a trans lady on called Jordan Gray. And I asked her tons of questions about the trans community and trans world. And she was brilliant because really early on she said, I need to be clear, I can answer for me. I've not sent out the bat signal and kind of got everyone's, are we all agreed on this? Okay, here's what you can, here's
we've
the term you
meeting.
Can use.
We've all sat around the table and we've all agreed on that. Yeah,
here's the reaction you can have, here's the term you can use. But it's a similar thing there. But for you, what would be your kind of ideal reactions and ideal treatments of you or anyone who stammers?
Just patience and also listen, because I'm still talking.
Yeah.
You know, and actually I'm fairly fortunate now that I am fairly fluent, and obviously there are bad days and there are good days, but I can get through my sentences and if I trip up on a word, it's something like that. It's like a hesitancy.
Yeah.
That quite pained thing I had as a teenager where like nothing's coming out. Like, and I feel like I've been in it for like a long time, and then I try and deviate and change the word, or I say sorry, like I pop my head up and say sorry and then go back to making that G sound. I think in situations like that, I think just listen. And I wouldn't try and sort of complete a sentence, because that for me, again, and this is my personal experience, but that just feels like failure, and that just feels like...
It's such a natural thing for people to do, but again, I agree, it doesn't help. And I have that all the time. I'll have people kind of, oh, and it's people who are being nice. They're trying to be nice and help you out, but I'm all right.
Yeah.
I'll get there. We've all got more time than we realise in life. Everything seems to be such a rush.
Yeah.
I'll get to the end of this sentence. It's fine. I did have one about a couple of months ago when me and my partner were driving somewhere where I had to stop to take a breath because my stutter had gone on so long.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not going to be able to finish the word even if I can start.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah.
You know, I've got so far on this.
We need to take a break. Right,
let's start that one again. So,
what's your relationship with your stammer like with your loved ones as well? Like, is that a different thing to what it's like in sort of public or speaking to someone that you don't know? Like, how do your loved ones, what's their relationship with it, or how do they react?
As you said, the ideal situation there of just patience. But again, I think that comes from familiarity. So it's not to shame anyone who has previously finished the sentence of someone with a certain thing like that. It's an unfamiliar situation. That's part of the point of these conversations on this podcast, is to kind of go, look, you don't need to do that. We've got it.
Yeah,
we'll get there. But yeah, my family have always just had patience on it. And again, because of that, I probably stammer a lot less around them, because it's that relaxed and that calm situation, I guess. So we've had what. One thing you'd want to tell people who don't stammer, and that's to have patience and let's finish. What's the one thing you'd want to tell someone who does stammer and is struggling with it, or just having a tough time with it? What advice would you give, or guidance?
I mean, it's not general, but what I can say, I think all I can say is I can say what I wanted to hear or needed to hear or sort of didn't know I needed to hear. But always stick your hand up. Don't ever shy away from the situation. Yeah. You know, always put yourself forward. Don't let it stop you do anything, because actually the idea of it is always worse than it is. And it's sort of what we were saying earlier. It's like, at least for me, the more I talk about it, the more I sort of come to terms with it, the more I realise what an inward, insular, personal thing it is. That actually, out there, it's not as big or as dangerous or as, you know, portentous as it may seem in here. Just pop your hand up. Don't, if you're in a classroom and if you know the answer, if you want to read or if you want to do that part or if you want to stand up in assembly I mean, I don't know about you. I used to order the wrong drink in places because I would go, I can't say that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in restaurants, I'd go to the bathroom just before we ordered and tell someone to order my thing. And it's like, don't let it affect your life in small ways like that. Just drop coffee everywhere. don't let it limit you. I think that's what I'd say.
I think everything you've said today has highlighted how it is such a individual and personal thing. The fact that you were aware of your stutter during the performance and no one else was shows that it means more to you than it means to anyone else. The fact that you had to say your advice to people who don't stutter is be patient and listen highlights that we as humans do have a tendency that, again, I've noticed this before, that I'll be stuttering and I know that they've tuned out because they're thinking about what they're going to say next.
They've clocked out, yeah.
But that's just humans. Yeah, so yeah, equally... they're not going to care about your stutter because they're thinking about what their problems are or what they want to do. So again, it all highlights that it means so much more in your head than outside of your head.
Mm.
And that's, yeah, that hopefully will allow people to go, yeah, it's all right. Let's get on with it.
Also, most people are kind.
Yeah.
Like, really? I think so. And even if they do laugh, or even if they do try to get a sentence out of you, or they try and finish you, for most situations, I genuinely think this, it's them trying to help you. It's them trying to get you along. It's them trying to get the conversation. It's them not knowing. And I think that's important to state, is that it's you know, it's knowing what is actually kind, and that's listening, that's hearing hearing the words they're actually saying to you, and letting them finish.
That's perfect. I'll end it there. Before we go, are you on social media or anything that you want to plug or give out?
Plug myself. Yeah. I'm on Twitter. If you want to follow my Twitter, I try really hard at being funny. Excellent. So if you want to come and see me, you know, sort of crash and burn at George Sargi.
Excellent.
I've got three names because that's my mum's maiden name. So yeah, I've got three surnames floating out there.
Brilliant.
Cheers, Pip.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
There we go. That was George. I hope you enjoyed that. We certainly enjoyed the conversation. The next person I want to introduce you to, it's one of my favourite people I've ever had on the podcast. And we only had a 20 to 25 minute chat. But it's a young lady called Natalie Park. And I'd not met Natalie before. I didn't know much of Natalie's story. But by God, she was a joy to be in the room with. I came home and told my partner about this conversation and how much she's going to love hearing this chat, because she's just a wonderful young lady and she's been through a hell of a lot. Her story is tough, but I'm so pleased to have had her on the podcast, basically. So let's stop dancing around and let's listen to Natalie Park's story.
Can we start by you stating your name, your age and your occupation?
Yeah, my name's Natalie, I'm 28 and I'm a teaching and assessment officer.
Excellent. And what's your earliest memory of having a stammer?
It's quite a painful one, actually. Yeah. My earliest memory is, I was probably 5 or 6, and I'm sat around the dinner table, and it's my parents and my sister, and my parents have asked me how my day's gone at school, and I'm trying to tell them, but I'm stammering, and they're asking me what I'm doing, why are you doing that, stop that. So yeah, that's my earliest memory.
Yeah, that's tough. And how did things develop within your family of your stutter, within their understanding of it? And and how did that all come along?
I mean, obviously looking back, now I know full well that it was, that they were only reacting like that through lack of understanding.
Yeah.
Not knowing what's going on. Is there something wrong with our daughter? But I mean, those early days, even the doctors had no idea. So,
yeah.
But then as we started to seek better help and my parents started to understand, my mum is just absolutely brilliant. She's so understanding. She's always got my back. I know that I can talk to her about it whenever I need to.
Yeah.
My dad is a little bit more shy.
Right.
And he's a little bit, slightly more socially awkward. So I've never really spoke to him about it, but I don't feel the need to. I know he loves me. I know he's proud of me. So I don't feel that like I need to broach the subject with him.
Yeah. There's, I mean, obviously that being a very tough story, there's a real beauty in it as well, because it's, I don't know, it kind of shows that all initial reactions are okay and understandable, because it's an unusual, if you've not confronted it before, it's an unusual thing. The thing that we need to raise awareness for is informing those reactions, letting people know that it's all right. Nothing bad's happening. Yeah, it's fine. Everyone's going to be okay.
Yeah.
We're going to get through this, quite literally. And again, the fact that then your mum has gone on to be the most supportive person in it. So how are things at school when this started to manifest?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have memories of stammering at school sort of like primary school age. Yeah. I have very happy memories of primary school, fitting in. I had loads of friends. It wasn't until I reached high school and you're at that age where you're starting to become very self-aware and you're becoming aware of what other people think of you and how they see you. Mm-hmm. I had a different style of bullying. So I wasn't pushed or I didn't have like names shouted at me in the playground. It was more like psychological.
Right.
So I'd be drawn into a group, but then almost for entertainment.
Right.
That's how I feel looking back. So I definitely felt very other.
Yeah.
I had allies, but looking back, I almost feel as though they were too scared to almost be too associated with me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was right up until I left for college. Yeah, I really didn't have a good time. I mean, the worst sort of years were around my GCSE years. And during that time, I actually did try and commit suicide because I reached a point where I had no vision of a future. Yeah. Like, I couldn't see where I was going to go. I couldn't see a way out. I thought that if all these people see me like this and they treat me like this now, then how's it going to be out in the real world? And my parents always said, you've got to be ready for the real world. You know, that's where I have my work ethic from. So as soon as I left school, my parents were like, you've got to get a job. Yeah. So, I've lost my train of thought.
That's all good. So did you develop any coping mechanisms at that time? Was there anything that you'd do to ease your stammer or to make things flow a little easier? Or did you just kind of retract more from social interactions?
Well, this was the thing, because I was persistent. I wasn't a shy child. I was always very open, very outgoing, wanted to be friends with everybody. I did have speech therapy. Mm-hmm. I had both solo speech therapy and group speech therapy, but they actually had a really adverse effect.
Right.
And made it really, really worse. But looking back, I think it was because the techniques made me feel like I was speaking even more unnatural than speaking with a stammer.
Yeah.
I don't ever really remember hating the stammer. I think I've always accepted the fact that it was a part of me. I think it was more self-loathing just in general.
Yeah.
But other than that, I've just stammered. However I'm stammering that day, I just sort of go with it.
Yeah.
And I've found that over the years, especially as I moved into my 20s, the more I became to accept it, the more fluent I actually was.
Yeah, it's amazing how personal and how kind of internal it can be. And a lot of the things you've said there is that it's your belief of people's reaction or what people are thinking and things like that that would end up eating you up inside, and then that makes it worse. And you know, it becomes a self fulfilling prophecy in a way, because you believe that it's going to be bad, so it is bad, and then you believe that people are going to react strange, so you're then going to notice every reaction that they make and read a lot into it as well.
Yeah.
And that, I can see how that can just send you down a spiral and a spiral and a spiral. So at what point did you start to have that kind of that turnaround, that change your perception on what it is?
Yeah. Well, like I say, I went to college. I did a catering course. I did one that was in chefing and then one that was in hospitality.
Yeah.
So while I was doing that, I found my first job, and I started to realise that I can do this and I can be good at this. And I was good at it. And because it was manual, that just takes skill. So as I started to set myself goals and I would reach those goals, that would obviously make me feel good. And then in time, I'd think, right, I can do anything I want. So when I left college, I went into university, which is something that I never thought that I would do. So that again really spurred me on, that did, and I was able to gain so much knowledge there, which then helped me move up the ranks in a kitchen until I was a kitchen manager, head chef. Wow. So I think the key was I started to set myself goals.
Yeah.
Which was something that I hadn't really even thought of, because I felt as though I had nowhere to go. I thought, well, what's the point? But I started off small, and then over the years, I just can't stop setting goals now. It's ridiculous.
I love that. And it's beautiful as well, because there's a clear moment there, a clear hurdle that you've set yourself, but then overcome yourself. Because at your lowest point, your fear was that there's no future for you in the real world. And then you got into the real world. And as soon as you realised it wasn't all doom and gloom, there was literally no stopping you. It's like as soon as you're like, oh, I didn't get here and explode. I didn't get here and be told I'm not allowed in. I got here and it was all right.
Yeah. You know what? I felt like I had arrived in my world.
Yeah, yeah.
Finally.
Yeah.
So, and then it was literally the world was my oyster, and I've tried to live like that ever since. So yeah.
It's beautiful, but it also really highlights how damaging it can be as a young kid to have something that makes you feel that there is no future. Yeah. Obviously, to the extent that you might never have got to found out what was ahead.
Exactly.
You know, so it was only when you got there that you found out, oh, there's so many options, but you almost didn't get there because of how you were perceiving your stammer and how others were reacting to you and making you feel about your stammer. So it's massive to highlight that. And what do you feel could have been done differently when you were at school? Is there anything that you feel teachers could have done to either inform or prep the other kids better? Or do you feel there's anything that just the kids could have done? It's always tough because kids are kids.
Yeah.
Their reaction, even if it's horrible, it's going to be what their natural reaction is.
Yeah.
We can push to educate that.
Yeah.
And that's definitely a valid thing. But yeah, do you feel there's anything else that could have been done support-wise?
I think because of the way that I was treated by the others, because it wasn't in your face, it almost made me question my own sanity of whether it was actually happening. Is this happening, or is it just in my head? Am I taking it this way? So,
and it'll be easy for teachers to dismiss if you bring any of it up. Yeah. It's like, so what's actually happening? There's nothing actually happening. There is, but
But I never ever broached the subject with a teacher.
Yeah,
I've always been very self-sufficient. That's how I was brought up. Very independent, and I think I've always known that this was my journey, and it was only me who was going to be able to get myself to where I need to be.
Mm.
So I suppose I spent many years in survival mode. But I did have a few fantastic teachers, only one or two, who showed me the patience that I needed. But they actually engaged with me. I felt that there was a lot of teachers who were almost not scared to engage with me, but apprehensive to engage with me, almost as though they didn't want to have to make me stammer, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Almost as though they were doing me a favour.
Yeah.
But actually, that was just adding into that circle of isolation and feeling like another.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? Because there's going to be points where you might want to sit out a certain exercise or thing, but it's not going to help anything.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's not going to help you overcome these things, and or more, it's not going to help other people get used to it.
Yeah.
If you're constantly missing out on these things, then it's not going to help it become just more normal. So, was it at college, and when you were studying at a higher level, did you become more comfortable at that point in addressing it yourself to people?
Yeah.
Like talking about it and saying, oh, here's what it is. It's all right.
Yeah.
It's kind of not a big deal.
Yeah, I've always been very open to questions.
Yeah.
Even if others would perceive those questions as quite rude. So I've had people say, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, it's fine. I'm just stammering.
Yeah.
Because I would rather somebody ask than not ask and leave and think, was she all right?
Yeah.
Because then that creates speculation with them, and then they would go off. And this is something that I think of quite often in my job, where they may go off and then they're speculating between colleagues, where they might be like, or my assessor's got something wrong with her.
Yeah.
I think that's...
Yeah.
I don't want any grey areas with people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I always welcome questions.
I love that, and that's a beautiful outlook and approach, because part of awareness is letting people know that it's okay to ask these questions. Yeah. I think particularly in the world at the moment, there's so much fear and nervousness about asking questions,
yes,
because you're going to be accused of being insensitive or accused of being just of racist or this or that or all these other things.
Yeah.
Obviously that doesn't apply to this, but so many different terms. There's a fear of going, I don't really know what this means or what's happening here. Whereas if it's a genuine question, a genuine inquiry, then that should always be fine. That should always be welcomed. And it might get a little bit annoying on your part to have to answer the same question every time. But again, I think all of us develop almost a speech, a set routine, a set explanation. Here's what it is. And you can smash through that. So that's always kind of an easy one. So it's not as big a deal. And again, people are, a thing I think to get to people who are nervous about asking the question is, you and I, we're going to be aware that we're stammering. We're going to be aware that we've got a stammer or a stutter. It's going to be something that's been a huge part of our lives since we were children.
Mm.
So it's not a subject that's going to be a surprise if you bring it up to us. So it should be okay to bring up and discuss and question, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'm ending each of these chats with the same two questions. Before I get there, have you got any memories of a specific time when someone has reacted in a specific way that's affected you a lot? Or, I mean, positively or negatively, I guess. They've tend to have lent on the negative side, but either there. Because the reason I ask in this situation is, at school, when it was seemingly at its worst and at its darkest, it sounds like it wasn't even specific reactions. Mm. It wasn't a specific thing. It was a lack of reaction. It was an implication. So is there anything, any times that you've kind of had a real, oh, that hurt, or that felt great, that that's how you reacted and responded?
There's definitely one on the negative side that has always stuck out. I'll never forget, I was buying a book from Waterstones and it was really, really busy, and I was with my mum and I was probably a young teenager. And my mum always encouraged me to go to the till.
Yeah.
Because I would ask her to go, because she was hot on her P's and Q's and I would always stammer on thank you.
Right.
And I couldn't leave without saying it. So sometimes I could be stood there for ages.
Yeah. And it's at the end as well, so you know it's almost over. It's kind of like, we're done.
Well, were you thinking about that? Even before you've made it to the till.
Yeah. And you're thinking that the person is like, we're done. Yeah, why is this person still looking at me?
Yeah.
What's going on here? Yeah, it's kind of, yeah.
So the shop was really busy. I got to the till. I came to say thank you, and I got stuck, and it was bad. And the woman, so I finally said thank you, and as I turned to leave, the woman turned to her colleague and very loudly in the queue said, God, I thought she was having a fit. So that one has really always stood out as probably one of the worst sort of straight-up reactions I've had.
Yeah, that's unbelievably kind of insensitive. And it's mind-blowing to think, particularly someone who's studied hospitality would know that that's not... Even worse in a work situation to be... It's one thing in a social situation... Some people are pricks. That is what it is. We can't do anything about it. A bit of a work situation. It's magnified. It's like, how can you? Yeah.
Well, and in front of other customers, but that was probably like 15 years ago, and yet we're still seeing it. Obviously, with this story with Costa Coffee, still seeing these reactions.
Yeah. So I mean, that's the thing. That's one of the questions I'm ending on then, is what would you like to tell people who don't stammer about how to react and treat and engage with people who stammer?
I think for me, I just don't think a reaction's needed.
Yeah, that's perfect.
I just want you to receive me like I'm another human being.
Yeah.
Show me the same respect as someone who you deem as normal.
Yeah.
Whatever normal is. I mean, obviously, you thrive on the more positive ones.
Yeah.
But I just don't see the need for any reaction.
Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah. I love that. And what would you like to say to anyone who's got a stammer, who may be young and not really knowing what it is, how to cope, not to go back to your situation at school, but who's struggling about what might be ahead, what the future might hold, if there is a future? What message would you kind of like to share with them? Or what would you like to have heard at that point?
That's a good question. I'd definitely say there is a future. Mm. There is a future for you. You might not know what that is yet, but there are people in their 30s, 40s that still don't know what their future is.
Yeah.
And when you're at school, that is your whole world, but that's not your world. That's a world that's constructed by your parents, your friends, your family around you, the school. It, But that's... But there will be a time when you will feel like you're free and you can do whatever it is that you want to do without anybody saying, no, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? So just keep fighting.
Yeah.
Fight your fight and forget everybody else, because it all comes from within. It really does.
That's perfect. I love it. I'm asking everyone if they want to plug their social media or anything like that at the end. You're welcome to. Would you like to?
Actually, I would absolutely love to plug. So I am part of an international project.
Yes.
That is called Stamily. So I met this wonderful group of people when I went on an Erasmus Plus youth exchange trip to Italy last year.
Yeah.
And I spent the week with 40 other people who stammer from across Europe. And then when we came back, we decided to make this project. So we've got a website, which is stammerly.org. And we have people from Canada, Hong Kong, Japan, all Europe. And we just basically share our personal stories. We all attend our own events in our countries and we share reviews on those. So please check that out and share us.
I love it. That's perfect. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been great.
Thank you.
There we go. That was Natalie. Just as said, a joy. I enjoyed all of these conversations. I enjoyed the day. We did a photo shoot for a campaign that I'll be posting about as well. But that conversation just put me in such a bright mood for the rest of my day and week. And it's great because these are people who wouldn't have been on the podcast if it wasn't for my moving into becoming a patron of Stammer and indeed for International Stammer Awareness Day. So last up, another fantastic guy, all three of these conversations, but this one in particular, a conversation I learned a lot from. And again, it's weird, as me and George discussed, as you will have heard, Natalie has had situations where she's joined groups and sat down with other people who stammer, but a lot of people who stammer have never really sat down with another person who stammers and chatted about it. So it's enlightening, and Owen was someone that was a wonderful speaker and someone that I got a lot from this conversation. So let's hear the wonderful Owen Shears.
Right, so can we start by you stating your name, your age and your occupation? It sounds so professional, doesn't it?
That feels quite instant. My name is Owen Shears. I'm 45 and I'm a poet and author and a playwright, so a writer, essentially.
Yeah. And what's your earliest memory of your stammer?
That's a really interesting question. I gave a speech at the British Stammering Association conference last year, which sort of made me think about that. You know, that idea of when did that flow between the motivation to express and the means of expression somehow become, you know, decoupled. And I think the first thing I can remember is a specific word, actually. And that right. It became a bit of a family joke that as a child, 3-4 years old, I would pepper my childish speech by saying, actually. And of course, looking back, I not so much a memory, but I have a physical sense of why I did that, because actually was a word I could say. And so it was like a door that I'd use to get into my sentences.
Yeah.
So it must have been going on then, but the first concrete memory of it really affecting me would have been, you know, sort of nursery, you know, first year of primary school, when every day started with the register being taken and every child having to say, good morning, Mrs. Webber, you know, Miss Jones. And I'm sure, as is quite familiar to you and to lots of other people who stammer, that situation, having prescribed words you have to say at a prescribed moment, set a pattern that really kind of I struggled with for the next 15, 20 years of anticipation, anxiety, that sense of blockage. And I did all sorts of things to try and you get around it, sort of jumping in before it's my turn, cutting off the G and saying, good morning.
I was going to say, it's a hard start, isn't it? Having that G there is it's a dead... You don't get the running. You can't say, actually, good morning.
Yeah. Actually, maybe I should have tried that.
You can't sneak actually into good morning.
But I even remember, and in some ways this is the stronger memory, that there was a young boy, I can't remember his name, but I know that he was a Peruvian boy, and he offered to say it for me, which was so generous.
Oh, wow.
And he did, and we both got told off.
Oh, really?
Mm. So I think that set all sorts of patterns in association of not just the anxiety of stammering, but an idea that I should hide it. And so for a lot of my life, although I've been a stammerer, even some people quite close to me wouldn't necessarily be aware of it, because the anxiety becomes not being disfluent, but actually being found out.
Yeah, and then it becomes a second nature, that you're using these techniques to mask it, even when you're around people that you don't need to mask it, and you're not consciously wanting to mask it, but it's become your survival mechanism as such, right?
It has, you know, and now so much of what I do, so much of my life involves talking to people, you know, performing to a certain extent to audiences. So, you know, sometimes friends will joke and say, well, you know, you're really making up for lost time now, aren't you? But actually all of those, you know, very subtle techniques and devices, they're going on every day, every day. And on the whole, I don't mind. When I kind of get frustrated with myself, when I go, hold on, that's not good enough, is especially when, you know, if it's something that I've written, if it's a poem, if it's a piece of prose, and I'm changing the words as I'm going along to remain fluent. Mm. But actually kind of breaking up this piece of writing that I really thought about, and I really care about the order of those words.
Yeah. That's fascinating that, again, to see it, the need for functionality affecting your artistic fluidity, I guess, there. Because that's horrific. As someone who's a writer, you, particularly with prose, you will slave over every word. If you're planning to perform it, you'll probably slave over the space between every word.
Yeah, exactly.
And to have to have anything other than the art of the piece influence that is crazy.
It is crazy. And actually, for me, that was the turning point as well.
Right.
I would drive home from giving readings from my first book. I was 25 when it came out. A small book of poems called The Blue Book. And I would drive home with this real sense of frustration and anger sort of freighted within me. And for the first time, I found a frustration that was greater than my frustration at my stammer.
Yeah.
So I went, right, no, actually, I'm going to be true to the poem. I'm going to be true to the poet who wrote these. And I'm going to say the words that are on the page. And, you know, for me, that was a significant moment. Firstly, because it meant sometimes I would stammer. And you know what? It was fine. Mm-hmm. but something about allowing myself to sort of ride the poem and to be more concerned with what I'm saying than how I'm saying it also meant that once that fear of disclosure had gone, quite often I wouldn't stammer on places that...
Yeah,
so it was an interesting moment. That, and also coming across, I'm fascinated by this, I want to make a programme about it or something someday, coming across so many poets who stammer.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that is about, you know, are they poets because they have a different relationship with language or is it vice versa? But seeing other poets, you know, read and stammer sort of gave me that license as well.
Yeah, I got to do spoken word poetry, touring, headline touring to you know, to 600 to 1,000 people each night for a while, and I would talk to people afterwards and they would all assume I was really well-educated, and I'm not particularly well-educated, but I think my vocabulary came down to my coping mechanisms of having to find replacement words for words that I couldn't say. So I think it expanded my vocabulary there, and I think there could be a link there in a lot of poets who have stammers that you've become adept to manipulating language
again, as a survival mechanism rather than as a passion or as a joy. Yeah. It's just, no, I've needed to bend words and change words and make them fit together differently so that I can say them.
Yeah, I think that's so true. Anything else. You kind of have this mental thesaurus that you're flipping through at an amazing speed. So I think that's true. And I think undoubtedly it gives you a very attuned awareness of language. And actually something that you mentioned earlier, of language and silence.
The
silence of a blocked word or of yourself stammering, you know, through all of my teens and my early 20s was my greatest fear. But then you kind of turn that on its head and you become aware of the power of silence as well. And, you know, especially as a poet, and again, you'll understand this, the white space on the page is as important as the black ink. And so I think, I would like to spend some time interviewing lots of writers and poets about it because I'm sure that there is some kind of a deep linguistic connection between the two.
Yeah, do you find any added fear or pressure now in your adult life that, because again, as we've said, in what you do, if you're performing any of your pieces, then the spaces are important, but what's also important is when you break those spaces. Mm. So if you've left a gap, you can't come back in stammering.
No.
Do you know what I mean? You need to break that gap with, here's what I'm breaking it with.
Yeah.
So there's a strange extra pressure there. And in a way, I think there might be an excitement to put that pressure on so that you can't fail, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Right? Here's this gap. I can't end this. I can't have this amazing gap where I've got everyone on the edge of their seats. You know, I've got them in the palm of my hand, and then I come in with, and then I've dropped them.
Yeah,
I've slipped out of my hand. I've shaken them out.
I've had that experience. You know, one of my coping mechanisms used to be to put in an or an and that kind of thing, and I can remember doing that quite often on the last line of a poem.
Yeah, the big impact.
Yeah, and actually having people in the audience come up and go, oh, it's such a shame, why did you do that? So I think it can be positive. And I think the way you put it is really good, actually. That's sort of like, you know, this is too important to fail on. But it's a negotiation, isn't it, as well? Because, I mean, even doing this interview, I'm doing all sorts of little coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
So that we have the conversation. But in a reading situation, I suppose I try to make sure I do hardly any of those. And so if a stammer happens, I kind of try to be relaxed about it. It's a fantastic Irish poet called Kieran Carson, and I saw him read at the South Bank, and, you know, he would be reading beautifully fluently, and then his sledgehammer would come in. Sorry, I just said sledgehammer because his stammer was like a sort of sledgehammer or one of those pneumatic drills.
Yeah.
And actually it sort of became part of the performance.
Yeah.
And you accepted it as part of the whole, so... But it's something that's always there in the back of my mind. But I think, and it's something of an enigma. That's the other thing I realised, is that as you go through your teens and your 20s, hopefully you come to start to understand more of your mind and your body. But my stammer remained this enigma. I never quite understood why it happened and when it happened.
Yeah.
But I try and see that as a more positive thing now, sort of this bit of you that is you, but you still don't understand.
Yeah, the mysterious part.
Yeah.
I love that. So do you remember when you first started to kind of put together these coping mechanisms, or was it at school as that was the first place that you started to be hit with negative response, I guess?
Yeah, I think it definitely was school. And all
I guess at home you'd already started with the actually as a mechanism, but a subconscious one, but I guess a more conscious solutions, was that school?
Yes, I think it was school, and it was the landline telephone. I mean, you know, I'm 45 and I grew up in rural Wales.
Uh-huh.
So that landline telephone was my portal to friends, to possible girlfriends.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely my number one object of fear as well, because you take away that visual communication, everything relies on the voice. So there were all sorts of mechanisms, you know, sort of, you know, pacing, putting movement in with the speech, that used to help. In school, it was harder because quite often it was those situations where I loved English literature. That's why I became a writer, because I loved reading. And we used to do that thing where the class would take a paragraph each. And again, you know, the worst thing for someone who stammers, you could see it coming through the classroom. I know I'm three kids away, two kids away, one kid away. And actually, a lot of the kids were fine with it. It was interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think I did a lot of sport and I played a lot of rugby. But looking back, I think that was a coping mechanism as well.
Yeah.
I used to throw myself into these physical endeavours. I used to do lots of hill running, just sort of attack a hill, almost so I could end up on the top, exhausted, feel my heartbeat, feel my breath, and kind of be beyond language in a way.
Yeah.
So there were coping mechanisms, but in those situations, they quite often didn't work. And by the time I got to university, there was the tutorial system. So you were meant to come in and read your essay. And I can never work out if it was done with kindness or just practicality, but my tutor just used to say, oh, you know, for God's sake, Aaron, just give it to me, I'll read it.
Wow.
Which actually was kind of tough as well, because you'd sit there with your tutorial partner while the tutor read the essay, just to, so we can, you know, so we can use this hour without having to wait for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's not really the most helpful of
approaches,
is it? Really, because it's highlighting the problem and not giving an option of overcoming the problem.
No,
saying, here's the issue, I'm taking it away from you.
Yes.
Oh, right. Can't we figure out a way to make... No, okay.
Yeah.
On to you. So, so what do you feel the difference was between Owen in school or college or wherever and at home? Do you feel there was a different you because of the difference in reaction to how you spoke?
It's a really interesting question. I think there was. But then, like I said, it was an enigma. I used to think, okay, this is linked to nervousness. It's linked to, like, focusing on a certain letter that I know I find hard, a G or a P. And then I'd be at home perfectly relaxed and I'd do it with my parents. So, but I guess I would feel no need to hide it. Well, although I had two brothers and they could, you know, they're brothers on the whole, very understanding, but, you know, every now and then we get frustrated. But I think, yeah, you do become a different person because your speech is the conduit to your ideas, your opinions and everything. So I think you do become a different person. And if anything, what I've come to quite late in the day, I mean, it's been really recently that I've even talked openly about my stammer, really.
Yeah.
I wrote about it. There are poems about it. It's only sort of recently that I felt those two, the more public and the more private, I mean, sort of, you know, come together as one person. And it's been, I think it's been watching how there have been changes in approaches to stammering. A good friend of ours, their son has a stammer, and I was so impressed with this. He was getting bullied in school a bit, and his speech therapist and his school got together, and they said, well, actually, why doesn't he give an assembly about what it's like to have a stammer, which, you know,
wow,
as you'll appreciate, is...
terrifying.
So, exactly, terrifying. Yeah. And Nye, who must be 9 years old, he did it.
Wow.
And the bullying stopped, and the school gave him a trophy. And that was a 9-year-old teaching me a lesson. It really was. Yeah.
And that's some teachers as well who are handling it in the right way and knowing how to do it. I always remember a similar thing to your tutor not handling it in the most helpful of manners with hindsight. I remember my parents going into my school and going crazy at my teacher because on the first day he got me up in front of the class to say, he's got a stutter, so don't make a big deal of it. It's like you've just made the biggest deal of it in the world.
on the first day,
as said, when people are looking for someone else to be the target, it's like, there you go, all right, thanks, that's me, fuck then. that's me out.
It's interesting, isn't it, because it seems as though in terms of, you know, issues around speech, this is all happened quite late in the day. You know, so after university I applied to the BBC training scheme and was effectively told on the phone that, you know, things were going well until there was an exercise where you had to cold call someone, pretend to be a researcher. And I said beforehand, I said, look, in stressful situations, I'm not great on the phone. This might not go well. And it didn't go very well. And they phoned up and they said, well, as a BBC researcher, you will be on the phone a lot, so we can't give you a position. Mm. And at the time, I kind of went, oh, dear, that's a shame. But looking back, I couldn't help thinking, is that legal? Is that allowed? You know, because there are all sorts of other reasons that you couldn't discriminate against someone.
Yeah. And because of how it is in your head at that time, you probably would have gone, yeah, fair enough, I
exactly.
guess. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I get it. But in reality, no.
Yeah.
It's not fair enough. It should be perfectly okay. It's not on my list of questions, but let's talk about telephones for a bit, because that's a massive, or as a kid, that was a massive one for me. I think in reality, as an adult it is, but I think so much of it is subconscious. I think the advent of being able to do almost anything on an app has made me far more relaxed, because I'm not having to ring for a cab or for a takeaway or for this or for that. It's just, there you go.
That sounds so familiar.
It's all done.
And email. Yeah. I loved it when email came around.
Yeah, and texting.
Yeah, that was
all of it.
All of that is playing to my strengths.
Yeah, completely. And it's when Jane first started working with the BSA and Stammer, one of the key things that she wanted to raise money for was a text service, because the only helpline they had was a phone line. And it's like, well, that might put off.
Yeah.
It will put off a huge percentage of people who need that helpline, because God, no, am I getting on the phone. So do you remember the first time that was, or do you remember any times in particular that was highlighted as a massive issue?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, my childhood was peppered with, you know, either answering the phone and then hanging up and, you know, lots of pretending that we've been cut off.
Yeah.
Or there's one specific, well, actually quite a few memories of phoning your friends' houses and praying for the friend to pick up, and then their parent picks up, and they literally thought that they'd been phoned by a heavy breather. You know?
Yeah. I had that with a family member at one point.
Really?
Genuinely. And it was my aunt's husband at the time, who isn't around anymore. I mean, he's alive. but he ended up hanging up for me because he didn't know what was going on. He was like, he thought it was either a heavy breathing thing or some kind of prank.
Yeah.
And I was trying to ring to say thank you for a present or something, you know, that kind of, in that era, you have to ring up to say thank you or write
a
letter.
Good for you for doing it. Because to be honest, what I remember is loads of avoidance.
Yeah.
Just doing anything, not to use the phone.
Oh, that was the last time.
Yeah, right. And that's odd, isn't it? Because then the mobile phone comes in, and you think, oh God, this is just going to get worse and worse. But I said earlier that movement helps.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously people can't see this, but I move my hands on now. And so even now, if I talk on a mobile phone, I'll try and do the conversations when I'm walking.
That's fascinating.
I'll move around the room.
Because I've never been aware of movement being a coping mechanism.
Really?
And I think it probably is subconsciously, but because I've always wondered why the phone is so much harder than just face-to-face. And I think it's because, particularly in that era, the phone was attached to a wall.
Yes.
So I'm standing still.
Yeah.
So it makes perfect sense now you're saying this, that movement can be a thing. And I probably do it all the time, but to get you off to a running start, as I think the easiest way to describe it always is, kind of gives you that, right, and we're going.
Yeah.
It's all off.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating that.
Which is why, you know, and I've got to be absolutely honest now, the only thing, and I do get angry with myself for doing this, and I shouldn't, and maybe I will make that promise to myself here now, is sometimes when, you know, there's a situation where I'm asked to do a live radio interview down the line, so you can't see the presenter, and it's live, so you can't correct any mistakes. And, you know, sometimes I'll just find a reason to not do them.
Yeah.
But I think it's the same thing, because you're sat in a studio, you're still.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's very little movement, or, you know, room for movement.
Yeah.
Both literal and, you know, metaphorical.
Yeah. So I've got two questions that I want to end on. One is, or before I get to those two, actually, have you got any strong memories of when someone has reacted particularly badly, or someone's reaction has affected you particularly?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there were lots in school. I mean, and oddly, sometimes it was the well-intentioned ones. You know, people coming up and saying, oh, you're just trying to talk too fast. Just slow down, you know. And really well-intentioned.
<Thank you.
laughs> I know, but then you get frustrated. Or, again, people very kindly finishing your sentences. That's probably... Mm. So they're not specific memories.
Yeah.
But they're kind of general ones like that. No, I mean, on the whole, actually, people are normally very kind. I think the worst one for me was, you know, and again, it's full of complexity and apparent contradictions, I think, stammering, because it was also in school that I started acting. And I found that playing someone else, being on stage, being under lights, I could do. Not always. I used to sometimes, you know, change the lines and stuff. And I've since found out that some very famous actors went into acting to cope with their stammers. So I think it was odd because people knew I stammered, but they also thought I did that kind of thing. And there was, again, a school assembly. I was in the sixth form and I was asked off the cuff, oh, someone's dropped out. Can you just introduce someone or read this? And I got up in front of the whole school. And I was one of the oldest in the school, so I was meant to be there in, you know, a position of authority. And the stammer kicked in, and it was awful. And, yeah, kids, of course, everyone laughed, everyone was confused. And, yeah, I walked out of school and ran straight up the nearest hill.
Wow. It's. I mean, I think one of the things I've enjoyed the most from your description of it, and again, it's rare that people... with stammers sit down and talk to another person with a stammer about their stammer. So it's quite an unusual thing. One thing I've enjoyed the most is your description of what an enigmatic thing it is and what a mysterious thing it is. And I think that's one of the reasons it's quite a hard subject to raise awareness of and to raise money for, because if you or I are asked to go on TV to talk about it, we're professionals.
Yeah.
We've spent a lot of time that in that situation, there's a good chance I'm not going to stutter once because I've really spent my life making sure that in these work situations, I'm on the radio, I'm on TV, I'm doing whatever, I will have it under control. That, ironically, doesn't help the cause.
No.
If I was on there struggling with every word, it would help the cause more than me going on there and speaking eloquently and saying, here's what it is. People are going... Yeah, it looks like a right struggle, mate. What a sad problem you've got. And again, our conversation here, we've started once or twice each of that. But it is a real thing and it is enigmatic and you don't know. I liked when you were saying how at school, these G's and B's, and that would be a big problem. But at home, you just breeze through them. So it's not something that you can control in that way. So it's...
And I'm sitting here talking to you because of my memories of my teen and my 20s. That's absolutely when I think of me then. And going to the British Stammering Conference and meeting people who were stammering with, in some ways, with more confidence than I was. They weren't trying to avoid words. They weren't changing words. That was a real, you know, a real trigger for me as a memory. And interestingly, I may be wrong because obviously we're attuned to this kind of thing, but our two-year-old daughter, she started talking. She's got lots of language, but she's... really kind of blocking on the first word of sentences. That could just be a two-year-old learning to talk.
Yeah.
Or it could be that she has a stammer. So, you know, that I think has got me much more invested in just there being a better sense of awareness, you know.
Well, I mean...
understanding.
With that in mind, let's get to these two questions. And the first is, what would you like to tell or inform people who haven't got a stammer on the best way to react? Because again, I think a lot of it is just, as you said, people trying to finish your sentence out of politeness. But if they knew that that might not be the biggest help, then...
Yeah, absolutely. I think wait.
Yeah.
Be as patient and as kind to someone who you come across who maybe has problems with their vision or problems with their hearing. And, I mean, I guess that is probably the main aspect. And understanding that fluency and being articulate are not the same thing.
Yeah, that's a great one. It's not that you don't know how to speak or what to say. Exactly. It's an inability, and it's not that necessarily that you're nervous. Yeah. It's a stutter. It shouldn't be reflecting or implying anything other than I stutter.
Yeah.
Not I'm nervous, I'm scared, I'm confused, I don't know what to say in this situation. I stutter. That's all it's telling you. It's not telling you anything else about me.
And this might sound odd, but I've only just thought about this, but in this world that is speeding up all the time, in which so much communication is so fast. If you're in a conversation with someone who stammers or stutters, enjoy the slower pace.
Yeah.
Immerse in language.
100%.
You know, I mean, that might be asking quite a lot of people, but, you know, treat it as a different experience, a different form of communication.
So what would you say to someone who has a stammer or stutter and is struggling or is young and doesn't know what the future holds?
Wow. God, that really gets me, actually, because that, you know, I can remember being that person.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say that things are much better. Things have improved. That hopefully there is a greater awareness. I'd say, hypocritically, do all the things that I didn't. Try to meet and talk to other people who stammer. If I'd met other people who stammered or talked about it openly to me, that would have been much, much better. And try not to be scared about being found out as a stammerer. Because that became the greater anxiety for me. And I think what you'll realise is that if you stammer, it's fine. Because what people value is authenticity.
Yeah.
And what is valuable is your ideas and your opinions, not how fluently you say them.
Yeah, that's perfect. Well, thank you very much. And can people find you on social media and stuff like that?
They can. I'm kind of an intermittent person on social media, but I am on Twitter. I'm there. That's probably all I'm on, really. Yeah. And I do have a website. It's probably horribly out of date. I need to get with the 21st century.
It feels weird to ask people if they want to do plugs at the end of this conversation, but I want more people to be engaging regularly with more people who have stammers, and it's not the defining factor. So it is kind of, it's like, it's to have those plugs and pushes and find those things. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, well, thank you so much. Dilke Marianne.
And there we go. That is everyone. I hope you enjoyed this, and thank you to everyone who's listened. Obviously, you will know that this episode means the world to me, so I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'd love you to share this episode and shout about it far and wide. Shout about it, because we can't. No, we can, really. We can use social media. That's not how stammers work. But yeah, and please start following Stammer UK on Instagram, STAMMAUK. As said, I'll be doing tomorrow on October 22nd, I'll be doing a takeover, I believe, on the Instagram and answering your questions. So come and get involved in that. I'd love to hear from you all. But yeah, follow Stammer on Twitter at STAMMER, and the BSA and Stammer are on Facebook. So yeah, I know that a lot of people will only be following those pages if they have a stammer, but hopefully this conversation it will have done what the goal of it was to do, is to raise awareness. International Stammer Awareness Day. The point is awareness, because as we learned when I had Tourette's Hero on, she beautifully put that she's also in uses a wheelchair, and she said that people have said to her, oh, that must be so restrictive, and she said, well, no, the world is restrictive. My chair gives me freedom and the ability to move. It's the inaccessible buildings that are restrictive. It's the reaction that's restrictive. And that's the case with a stammer or a stutter, I think. As you will have heard here, everyone you've just heard, their stutter has been better and better in situations where everyone knows the drill and they can relax. It's when it's worse is when people don't know how to react, or people react negatively, or people react trying to help but not quite in the right way. So this push for awareness is for you guys. It's not for us guys. We know what living with a stammer is like. Believe me, it's something that we confront every day. Literally every day of our lives, at some point, there will be a moment where we think, oh man, that was annoying. Or we feel embarrassed or ashamed or awkward. And that shouldn't be the case, you know. So yeah, thank you for tuning in. Obviously, we've got a regular episode on Wednesday. I'd urge you to go and listen, if you haven't, to the episode I did with Joe Gilgan, because we talk... That's one of the first places, or one place, that I really talked about my stammer in acting and stuff like that. And he talks about his bipolar. And also, I said, I did a King's Speech episode on Christmas Day of last year, and I discuss the year I'd had engaging with stammer and the BSA and becoming part of it, and the struggles it caused, but the reward and payoff it's given me. So yeah, I'm rambling on a bit. As you will have heard, there's been no plugs in the... Oh, I need to remember to turn the adverts off. I might not have turned the adverts off. If there's adverts, I apologise. But they get dropped in. I've not recorded them specially. But yeah, I hope you've enjoyed this. I hope it's been enlightening. Huge thanks to Jane and Kate at the BSA. To Liam, who did great photography with us. For a campaign that's going alongside all of this. And huge love to you guys for tuning in and listening. Obviously, most of all, huge love to George Fletcher, to Owen Shears, and to Natalie Park. Thank you for tuning in, guys. Shout about this. You can hear I'm normally far more rambly, but I'm kind of a bit... Hopefully, the pauses that you're hearing are the weight of importance that this particular episode has to me. This episode hasn't been about me, as most episodes aren't. It's been about my three amazing guests, but it's so much I relate to. It's so much bigger than chatting to my idols of film, of comedy, of music. It's chatting to people who have now become my idols of the way they live their lives and the struggles they've overcome and the relatable issues they've had, but the way they've dealt with it and continue to deal with it. Stammers aren't something that need to be cured. There's obviously options there. There's options and there's therapies that can help some and cannot help others. But the key message, I guess, is we're not broken. This is just part of who we are. And it's the reaction, it's the response and reception that a stammer can get that is the problem. And the more we can spread this awareness, the more we can solve that hurdle, that issue. And we can have greater representation in TV, in film, on radio, of people who stammer. And it's not a big deal. I love that so many of you all listen to this podcast. And I rarely talk about my stammer, but it's there every... I almost swore. I'm trying to keep it clean on this one because it's a cause. It's there on every episode, man. You'll always hear it. And you guys don't care anymore. And that means the world. And I know this is just a little independent podcast, but it's grown to a decent size. And I think it's a good test pool for what we could do on a grander scale and platform. Emotional episode this. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back on Wednesday with the amazing Daisy Haggard, who is the writer and star and creator of a great series called Back to Life. She was also in Man Stroke Woman and numerous other things. So yeah, thank you for tuning in, guys. Hopefully I'll hear from you all online today, and more importantly online tomorrow on October 22nd for International Stammer Awareness Day. I'll see you on all the socials. Have a good one. And thank you again.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.